Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of the Diplomats Podcast. This week, we have a guest with us. We have assistant professor at the University of Kentucky's Patterson School of Diplomacy, Robert Farley, and one of our Flashpoints authors as well, here with us today. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thanks for having me on.
And today we'll be speaking actually about Rob's new book, which is Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force, in which he makes an argument, naturally, for integrating the United States Air Force assets with the Navy and the Army. The way I see it is that the key argument here is that the United States needs air power, but it does not need an air force.
Right. That's sort of the tagline, but that's the basic argument is that we can maintain at least the important parts of American air power without having an independent bureaucracy that we call the United States Air Force.
All right, sounds good. So, Rob, so you know, Zach and I are clear, and our listeners are clear as well. Could you just kind of go over the basic outline of your argument in the book?
Yeah. I mean, the argument is that we founded the Air Force in 1947 for very specific reasons, because of the belief that we needed an organization that could be devoted, that could devote itself to strategic air power, to air power for independent decisive effect. That this is what the Air Force had tried to do in World War II in both the European and the Asian theaters, or the Pacific theaters, and that in the Cold War, in what was becoming the Cold War, it would be necessary to establish an organization with its own resources, with its own political pull, with its own ability to train itself and set its own priorities, in order to develop a deterrent against the Soviet Union and to do whatever else the United States needed to do. And the motivating concept behind this was strategic bombing, that Air Force strategic bombers would maintain the peace and would punish wrongdoers, and that this would be sort of the central way in which the United States used force. And my argument is that what this does is it sort of inherently privileges a particular vision of air power, this being the strategic vision over a more tactical and operational vision in which air power is in support of sort of more complex uses of military force. And that through the Cold War and into the post-Cold War era, it's really much more common that we end up with these more limited, more complex, more joint ways of using American force, of displaying American force, and that the independent Air Force, the United States Air Force, is still incompletely constructed to accomplish those goals.
Thanks.
How much is this tied onto your view that the strategic bombing just doesn't work, like the Robert Pape argument? And I know you've made this argument, because a lot of the critics of your argument say, like, mm-hmm. this de-emphasizes how powerful strategic bombing really is. So if you should maybe respond to that.
You know, I mean, it's interesting. There have been two comebacks with respect to the strategic. To answer the first question first, it's a pretty serious part of this argument, right? The attack on strategic bombing is pretty central to the case that I'm making. Now, the comebacks have been twofold on that. The first is, and you hear this from a lot of actual Air Force people, is that you're totally missing that the Air Force does a ton of other things that aren't strategic bombing, and that would ruin all those things if you took away the Air Force, which is certainly an argument. And the other one is that, no, you're wrong. Strategic bombing really does work. And, you know, I guess my response to that one is, look, people are entitled to a whole set of opinions about history, but, you know, the historical record does not strongly or even, in my view, weakly support the proposition that strategic air power works in the way that aviators and air power theorists have told us it's going to work, right? Aviators, they tell us over and over again, this is how air power is going to work. So we're not testing against some sort of blind metric. We're testing against the metrics that aviators themselves have set, the predictions that Air Force enthusiasts have set, and they fail.
Now, very briefly, what are some of these cases that kind of, you know, back up that claim? I think that'd be interesting to hear about.
Well, so, pardon me. World War II is a good start, right, where there is a clear and long history of air power enthusiasts in the United States, a paper trail of air power enthusiasts in the United States and in the United Kingdom, making the argument that fundamentally the other aspects of the war, including the D-Day invasion, including the invasion of Italy and so forth, that these were essentially sideshows, and that full commitment to the strategic bombing offensive, the combined bomber offensive, is the one thing that will defeat Germany, and will defeat Germany at the lowest cost. And during the war, this was made straight, you know, why are you possibly considering using or actually invading Europe to attack the Germans? Because that's just where the Germans want you to be. And you would think that sort of at the end of this, when Germany was in ruins, but we still had to occupy Berlin, that you would have some retreat from that position. But you don't, really. In Vietnam, the people, aviators will often talk about Rolling Thunder as if it was something imposed upon them. The strategic bombing campaign against North Vietnam was designed to undercut North Vietnamese support for the Viet Cong. But in fact, aviators developed the campaign, and they predicted, you know, again, in no uncertain terms, that this campaign would be sufficient to drive North Vietnam from the war and to force North Vietnam to accept the existence of South Vietnam. You know, didn't work out that way. In Iraq in 1990, Colonel John Irwin, he was a lieutenant colonel at the time, John Warden and a faction of the Air Force, that actually included David Deptula, made the argument that the Air Force, that we should respond to Saddam Hussein's aggression, not by deploying a big army to push him out of Kuwait, but by carrying out a short air campaign focused on Iraqi command and control and Iraqi government targets, leave the Iraqi army completely intact in the desert because we would need it to go back and occupy Iraq after the war was over, which would be happen in no time because we would be attacking Iraqi government targets. You know, again, false short of the predictions. Mm-hmm. And then I think even in Kosovo, right, where you have the entire array of Western air power against a small isolated country, and it still takes 78 days to win the war. I think all of these are cases where strategic air power falls short.
Right. Now, so does this argument apply to other air forces? Because, you know, in the title of your book, you specifically talk about the United States Air Force. But I was wondering, you had an interview with us for The Diplomat where we asked you a bit about this. But I wonder if you could go over the implications for, you know, other militaries, if this is a generalizable trend or if your case is specifically applicable to the United States military the way it exists.
Right. The argument is most applicable to the United States and the United Kingdom, where you have a particular combination of institutional structure and Air Force culture, where you have sort of a cultural disconnect between aviators and the other services that produces a lot of conflict between them. There have been other cases in other countries where independent air forces have worked very well in ways that you would expect them to, or that you would want them to, where air forces have done an excellent job of supporting the other services, have done an excellent job even of commanding the air. So the Luftwaffe in World War II is a good example. The French Air Force has historically done fine. There are institutional aspects of it that are applicable to any framework. And so every country has to worry at least a little bit about creating an air force that's going to act in its own bureaucratic interests. But in the context, especially of the United States and the United Kingdom, this institutional framework is complicated by a cultural problem with the other services.
I go piggybacking on that question. What do you think would happen to say if the U.S. took your argument and abolished the Air Force? How would that impact like its interoperability with NATO or Japan or South Korea? Would that harm that, do you think?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there are certainly concerns, and somebody, a friend of mine, is writing a paper on sort of why we have so many independent air forces. And one of his arguments is that one of the reasons we have them is because, you know, air force or aviators in one country want to be able to interact on equal basis with aviators from other countries. And so that kind of interoperability, or the need for interoperability, thus produces a bunch of independent air forces. But, you know, the Canadians did abolish their Air Force in 1968 and their Navy and everything else. And, you know, that's a process that has had its ups and downs, its back and forths. You know, the Canadians weren't entirely happy with what happened. But I don't know of any complaint about the Canadian system that focused on interoperability. That said that they could no longer manage their relations with other with other NATO countries. During World War II, the United States Army Air Force worked fine with the Royal Air Force. So I don't see the serious problem.
I have a question. How do we bridge the gap here between theory and reality? I mean, you obviously make a very compelling argument for abolishing the Air Force, but given that, you know, as you've noted, there is a lot of blowback from the U.S. Air Force itself, a lot of aviators, a lot of people who maybe have a different view of air power. How do we take this and, you know, lobby for it to actually be implemented in the United States? To add to that, do you think this is realistic?
You know, when I started writing on this, and this started with an article in the American Prospect about 7 years ago, and so I've been writing sort of very much on this topic for a few years. And I would have said, it's not that realistic because we do have to assemble a bipartisan coalition in the United States. And it turns out that bipartisan coalitions are hard to come about in the United States, especially right now. But things have changed, right? I mean, the Republican Party has changed, and how the Republican Party views military spending, military force. I think that there's more of a prospect now for serious military reform, you know, not just getting rid of the Air Force, but potentially getting rid of the Air Force, in terms of a serious coalition between, leftish Democrats and Tea Party-oriented Republicans than there's been in a really long time. And it's a coalition that has come together on some issues. It's come together to some extent on intel, and it's come together on some defense budget issues, which is why sequestration persisted. But I think, in terms of thinking about major reform, it's actually more realistic now with the change in the GOP than it was 7 years ago when that change was really hard to expect.
I mean, one of the easiest ways to get politicians on board is to show them that, you know, you'll reduce costs by doing this. Have there been any feasibility studies or any sort of research on what the actual budgetary implications would be of this?
No, I haven't had the resources to sort of put all of, you need a ton of research assistance and everything else to try to make those kinds of assessments. What I usually say when asked is, in the short term, there are significant costs to really big institutional reforms. But in the medium term and the long term, there are lots of redundancies you can look at getting rid of. Basing redundancies, capability redundancies, training redundancies, logistical between the services. And in the long term, this also, I think, opens the door to pretty serious procurement reform. Right? It's breaking the golden rule by which all of the services get roughly the same amount of money each year, which produces a ton of stuff that, for defense, we don't necessarily need.
Absolutely. And it strikes me that we're always trying to build planes and that can operate across the three services, or at least some parts are interoperable between the three mm-hmm. services, and that would definitely help with this. So, that's a huge thing, I think. Mm-hmm. When we talk about that, it's kind of a little moving on a little bit, but I was just wondering, what's your general assessment of the F-35? Because there's been some disputes, war is boring, people seem to hate it, then second line of defense, people love it.
It's a deeply troubled program that may still, in the end, at this point, I think that the people who hate it, this is a sort of a coward's way out, but at this point, I think that the people who hate it have to sort of say, okay, well, I hate it, but it's going to be, because it's so difficult now. I mean, Lockheed Martin has done such a good job of making this program unkillable on both a domestic and an international, on the domestic and international seats, that it's worked. They've made it unkillable. And so we have to say, okay, well, what now? How do we go forward? And the answer to how we go forward is probably the Air Force buys a ton of them, the Marines get what they want out of the F-35B, and the Navy buys just a few and then starts working on other things, which is what I expect the Navy will do and what a lot of people expect the Navy will do. How that relates to what we're talking about today, the big problem with the... you can't talk about joint fighter programs without thinking about how institutionally they come about. And basically the F-35 and its predecessor programs like the F-111 and a little bit differently the F-4 come about in this specific set of institutions that we have. And so even, you can't say the Air Force is necessarily at fault for everything that happened with the F-35, but the structure of procurement that the Air Force is part of is most certainly at fault. And so I think that, you know, doing major reform and breaking this golden rule service system is a way to prevent future F-35s.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about this in the interview, but I was just wondering if you could maybe explain to our listeners about how your abolishing the Air Force would hurt or help the U.S.'s ability to execute air-sea battle.
Sure. So air-sea battle is basically, you know, its name comes not from the 1980s in television video game, but from the U.S. Army doctrine in the 1982, which was called air-land battle, which was this idea of a joint coordinated campaign to defeat the Soviet Union in defeat the Warsaw Pact in Eastern Europe, or in Central Europe. And that integrated Air Force capabilities, Air Force tactical capabilities, into Army capabilities. And that was done at a time where Army-Air Force relations were still pretty good, or actually probably better than they are right now. Now, air-sea battle takes that name, but is really something that's much more a collaborative product between the Navy and the Air Force. So air-land battle was the Army and will invite the Air Force along, and the Air Force will say, okay, whereas air-sea battle is the Air Force and the Navy really working together. And that's fine. They should be trying to work together, because every time the services are forced to interact with one another, there are always problems that you don't expect. But it's still a less ideal solution than saying, okay, why don't we just take the capabilities that are of particular interest to the Navy and put them in the Navy so that you know, the Navy can, you know, wage a conflict that is right in its wheelhouse, you know, the broader Pacific, right? And if you think about this, and you think about constructing a doctrine and a set of capabilities under the rubric of one service rather than between two services which have different ways of approaching warfare, I think that you get a potentially much more coordinated and much more sensible way of approaching war.
All right. Well, Rob, thanks a lot for joining us. That was a very interesting interview. For listeners, that was Robert Farley again discussing his new book, Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force. Keep an eye out for his articles on our Flashpoints blog. And thanks a lot, Robert, for joining us.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.